focus on precisely the social environment and the permitting social environment. Because if I'm inclined to sexually harass, the likelihood that I'm going to do so is much smaller if I think other people aren't going to be accepting that behavior.
Despite investment in training and grievance procedures, sexual harassment, especially in male-dominated workplaces, has been surprisingly hard to eliminate. My guest today has experimented with a different approach that might just be more effective. Welcome to Vox Talks Economics from the Centre for Economic Policy Research. I'm Tim Phillips. Now think of a male-dominated occupation. Well, many of you might have thought of the military. A modern army has both male and female recruits, but not always a modern attitude to sexual harassment. In Norway, an experiment has investigated whether a new approach to combating harassment might be effective in this very demanding context. Johanna Rickner of Stockholm University and CPR is one of the authors of a new discussion paper about the experiment. She joins me now. Johanna, welcome to Vox Talks Economics.
Thank you very much.
How prevalent is sexual harassment in the workplace? What are the negative impacts of it?
A lot of research shows that this is a very prevalent problem. Of course, it depends on exactly how you ask people about it. Mm-hmm. But anywhere between 20 to 50% of women are expected to experience it at some point in their work life. And research on consequences document correlations with stress, worse mental health, deterioration of teamwork, and many other things like worse job satisfaction, etc.
As you said, it depends very much how we measure it. How are we measuring it in this case? What do you define sexual harassment to be?
One gold standard measurement method is a behavioral questionnaire where instead of asking people, were you sexually harassed? We ask about a list of behaviors and the person indicates if they experienced each one. So that's the method we used in our military context to measure the prevalence of sexual harassment and also which behaviors were the most common. Mm-hmm. So the typical categories of sexual harassment would be unwanted sexual attention, behaviors of a sexual nature that the person doesn't want. It could also be coercive behaviors to kind of extract sexual compliance in exchange for either promises of reward or under some threat. And additionally, sexual harassment can be so-called gender harassment, which are hostile or derogatory behaviors based on gender, but not necessarily sexual in nature.
Employers have put policies in place. HR departments have processes for victims to complain. It seems that this isn't effective. It certainly hasn't solved the problem. Why is it not more effective?
Grievance processes where victims complain tend to be inefficient because victims are really reluctant to complain. And that reluctance is rational because complaining tends to carry large costs, both in the social environment, other people think of you negatively, and in a professional sense where the employer would either trivialize the claim or the report, or they would maybe move the person who complained needs to switch jobs rather than there being some sanction for the perpetrator of the harassment. So people don't use the grievance report, and therefore it is inefficient to address this problem.
Now, I characterize the military as being a particularly demanding environment for this, having a poor track record on harassment. You see some news reports.
Investigators say she was sexually harassed by a supervisor at Fort Hood, and military leaders ignored her allegations.
It's been called an unprecedented legal case. The law firm behind the case is alleging widespread systemic sexual violence, harassment, abuse, discrimination, even
rape. Several women have told the BBC they were sexually assaulted and harassed at a British Army college when they were just 17.
Does the military have a particularly bad record on sexual harassment?
Both women and men, the military has been emphasized in research as one of the occupations with high rates. And one reason that women face so much harassment there is, of course, that it's a very male-dominated occupation, both in a numerical sense, like women in the military tend to be surrounded by a lot of potential perpetrators, like lots of men, but also in a stereotypical sense. So when we think of a military like soldier, we tend to think of a man first, and maybe the things that make you a good soldier, like being aggressive, some traits of the person that we associate more with men than women. So when women hold those jobs, they become more salient in the work environment and they become perceived as not fitting in and therefore more exposed to these types of derogatory, denigrating comments on women's capabilities of doing the work. So gender harassment is expected to also be high in the military, and it is.
The military isn't the only work environment with a poor track record of hostility to women. In November 2023, we spoke to Gianmarco Danielli about the history of violence towards female politicians in Italy. Were they targeted because of their policies or their gender? When you follow Vox Talks Economics, wherever you get your podcasts, you can find out when you listen to the episode called Violence Against Women in Politics.
So let's talk about this experiment that you did. It took place in boot camp. What kind of soldiers are we talking about? How many of them?
Yeah, so these are young conscripts, 18, 19-year-olds, who start their military service in Norway. And at the beginning of this service, they have a boot camp where they learn what they're going to be doing for the next year or so. So in this boot camp, they live together, like they go to a military base, they train, they're divided into teams who also live together in rooms. So these rooms are the small work environments that we focus on when it comes to trying to change the social environment to prevent sexual harassment.
Okay, now I'm imagining in the past that maybe part of boot camp, if they were addressing sexual harassment, would have been a lecture where someone stands up at the front and then tells them why sexual harassment is bad. Did they have this in the past? Did it work at all?
Yeah, I think the military might be doing things like that, but not necessarily at entry. So these young people, they come from high school and they're going to do their military service. So at this point where we give them our information, it's at the very like enrollment procedure stage where they do physical tests, they take surveys, they essentially spend a whole day at a base. And that's where we deliver our, you know, information before they do anything else.
What sort of information are you delivering them? How do you deliver it to them?
So the information was part of the survey that they take at enrollment. So the survey has many, many questions. It takes 20 minutes to do. And as part of that survey, some rooms, so some of these teams were randomly assigned to answer survey questions where we delivered two types of information aiming to prevent sexual harassment.
So that's all wrapped up in the survey. What sort of information is it?
Yeah, so each of these two pieces of information sought to prevent one of the two most common behaviors of sexual harassment that we discovered in this context in our prior surveys. So the most common behavior was negative derogatory comments about women's capabilities at the job. Yeah. So to change kind of the attitudes towards saying those things in the group, we delivered information about women's actual job performance. So in past cohorts of these military recruits, there were very detailed tests that they had to do at the end of military service. And those tests very solidly shows that there's no gender gap. Like women's and men's average score is the same. So in that part of the information, we show them like a bar chart, like for each cohort of recruits. And it's very obvious there, like it's visually very easy to see that there's no difference. Women are as good as men in being soldiers in this context.
Okay.
So therefore, we hope like, okay, then maybe people are going to be less likely to like kind of say that to each other when we tell them that that's not the case. And then the other, kind of the second part was aiming to prevent the second most common behavior, which was crude sexual jokes. So there, the treatment or the intervention was a bit more complicated because there we gave them information about what other people, like their peers in the same context. So what did other soldiers think about those crude sexual jokes? Did other people think that they were sexual harassment? So here we're trying to change kind of tolerance of the behavior by preventing a misperception that other people in the group are more tolerant than they actually are. In some workplaces where we have lots of sexual harassment, people might individually not enjoy that work environment, but they think other people do. So if we tell them the truth about what other people think, they might also change their own views and behavior.
Why did you believe that your approach might be more effective than whatever's been used in the past?
We already discussed one of the classical prevention methods, the grievance procedure, and why that was inefficient. And you mentioned another typical classical method of training sessions for employees. The reason that is being currently like critiqued a lot by experts is that telling people what to do might be inefficient in changing behaviors, because especially the ones that are most inclined to sexually harass, so the potential perpetrators, might not really want to be lectured in how to behave.
Right.
So if training sessions are voluntary, those people tend to not attend. Or if you force them to attend, some research shows that you even have like a backlash effect where they become more tolerant of the behavior because they resist this being lectured on this, like, I don't think we should be like that.
If you're looking for positive outcomes from this, what are you looking for? What are you trying to measure? What's a measure of success? How can you measure that?
Yeah, so first we were interested in measuring their own attitudes toward the behavior, kind of the attitudes that we think are underpinning the bad behavior, thinking that crude sexual jokes are okay as part of the work environment, and also thinking that women are less capable as soldiers in this context. So we asked them several questions about their own attitudes directly after reading our information, and then also 2 months later at the very end of the camp. So that changing attitudes, it's seen as a potentially important way to prevent sexual harassment, precisely because you try to treat the culture of the group to prevent the harassment before it happens, and avoiding these potential backlash from telling people straight up what to do, and maybe more costly, like holding training sessions is a cost in terms of time and resources. And instead you try the softer approach of preventing misperceptions, what other people think, women's actual capabilities, and in turn changing the culture. So we measure if we did manage to change that culture, people's attitudes. And then of course we asked also at end line, after boot camp was over, we asked if they experienced one of those behaviors from anyone in their team.
So, Johanna, tell me, was there an impact on attitudes? Did it change the culture?
Yeah, so there was a very big impact on attitudes. Attitudes changed by one half, a little more of a standard deviation in terms of survey questions, measuring aspects of women's competence in the military, and also attitudes toward these crude sexual jokes. And about half of that treatment effect remained 2 months after, which I think should be considered quite large. When it comes to the measurement of the prevalence of sexual harassment, we have negative point estimates. So if anything, there was maybe an increase, but we really struggle with the precision. So of course, we pre-registered this experiment. We had calculations that should have allowed us, like the size of the treatment effect looks large enough so that we should have had precision. But in the end, we didn't, because of some unforeseen measurement error, which I think can nevertheless be helpful for like future experiments on these new intervention types.
Well, tell me about this. What is it that gave that lack of precision and that measurement error that you weren't expecting?
In hindsight, it might have been, maybe should have been obvious to us, but when we treat attitudes towards specific behaviors and we make people understand that they are problematic, people are more likely to remember and notice those things in the work environment. So now all of a sudden, you know, I'm aware that women are actually equally capable at this job. and someone says something derogatory like, oh, women shouldn't be in the military, then I'm more likely to notice and then recall that. So there's like this counteracting effect on labeling and recall that pushes the prevalence measure upward in the treated rooms. So it like counteracts the potential negative effect on actual behavior that we have there.
So you might have a negative effect on behavior, but because people are remembering more of the behavior that they might not have noticed so much in the past, do these effects work in opposite directions when you're coming to recording the results?
I think that's certainly going on here, because one of the ways that we measured changes in attitudes was through kind of a vignette survey question where we gave them a scenario of a sexual harassment event that happened in the military boot camp, at least military service. Young people in Norway, it was a situation like their own. And we asked various questions like, do you think what happened was sexual harassment here? Do you think the bystanders should have intervened? What do you think the victim should, blah, blah, blah. And there's large kind of treatment effects showing that the rooms that we treated, the teams, were more likely to consider the behavior of sexual harassment. They responded really by changing various views on these situations in their own environment. That tells me, together with research, this labeling effect is known quantity in theoretical terms in prior research. If people are more aware of sexual harassment, they are going to recall more.
If you were going to do the experiment again, or, well, if someone else does a similar sort of experiment, is there a way to be able to measure the effect on behavior that doesn't have this bias?
There's no quick fix with the existing data that you can collect in a survey. I mean, you can, of course, measure the awareness itself, which we did in this case. I mean, we might need to have a different power calculation of how many observations we need to get precision after netting out this counteracting bias on the size of the treatment effect. But alternatively, we also need to have more innovative methods for measuring behavior. We need to collect data in a different way, ideally observational data on whether sexual harassment took place. Mm-hmm. I know, for example, people who look at sexual harassment in online environments, they have data from chats, messaging. You might do little focus groups looking at ways of collecting data on actual behavior in these groups. What's actually going on, not just what people said was going on.
But even without this clean result on behavior, if this intervention, if it changes the group dynamic, the way people feel about sexual harassment, is that a result worth having in itself?
I think it's certainly worth having in and of itself. These attitudes toward, for example, crude sexual jokes, is that something we want? Is that something we find problematic in our work environment? It's really the core models of why sexual harassment happens focus on precisely the social environment and the permitting social environment. Because if I'm inclined to sexually harass, the likelihood that I'm going to do so is much smaller if I think other people aren't going to be accepting that behavior. So just the impact on what people thought about the behaviors and what people thought about women's competence, I think are very important in and of themselves. And for sure, they made the Norwegian military incorporate these types of information that we had more broadly in the information they now gave to their recruits. So they also considered this very important in terms of changing culture and attitudes toward this behavior.
Well, that's a great result in itself. We think about the military as being unusual, but in some ways they're absolutely not, are they? This is a conscripted army, so I would imagine the people in it are fairly representative of the Norwegian population. These are people who are going to go into other workplaces. There are workplaces everywhere that are trying to deal with this problem. In what other context do you think that your approach might be effective?
This approach could be effective wherever we suspect these misperceptions persist. I spoke to Swedish organizations that do trainings on sexual harassment, for example, in the construction sector in Sweden. So they mentioned that this way people might perceive a good work environment and work environment that people appreciate might be very, very different from what people individually would prefer. And especially maybe for young people, they mentioned recruitment problems. Men come in and they maybe don't want this type of work environment. We can use this type of approach of collecting data on what other people think and solving this problem that the individuals might behave in ways they don't really prefer.
Let's hope more employers pick up on this. Thank you very much for talking about it, Johanna.
Thank you.
The paper is called Targeting Attitudes to Combat Sexual Harassment, a Randomized Intervention in the Norwegian Military. And the authors, Ole Folker, Torbjørn Hansen, Ashild Jonsson, Andreas Kotsadam, and Johanna Rickner. It is discussion paper DP21475 at CEPR.
Vox Talks Economics is a Talk Normal production. The assistant producer is Megan Bieber, and our editor is Andrei Zagarian.